far away, in a place called Silene, in what is now modern-day Libya, there was a town that was plagued by an evil, venom-spewing dragon. Who skulked in the nearby lake, wreaking havoc on the local population. To prevent this dragon from inflicting its wrath upon the people of Silene, the leaders of the town offered the beast 2 sheep every day in an attempt to ward off its reptilian mood swings. But when this was not enough, they started feeding the scaly creature a sheep and a man. Finally, they would offer the children and the youths of the town to the insatiable beast, the unlucky victims being chosen by lottery. As you can imagine, this was not a long-term sustainable option. But then, one day, the dreaded lot fell to the king's daughter. The king was devastated and offered all his gold and silver if only they would spare his beloved daughter. The people refused, and so the next morning at dawn, the princess approached the dragon's lair by the lake, dressed as a bride to be sacrificed to the hungry animal. It just so happened that a knight who went by the name of St. George was passing by at that very moment and happened upon the lovely princess out for a morning stroll, or so he thought. But when it was explained to him by the girl that she was in fact about to become someone else's breakfast, and could he please move on and mind his own business, he was outraged on her behalf and refused to leave her side. Either she was slightly unhinged and shouldn't be swanning about lakes so early in the morning all by herself, or at least with only a sheep for protection, or she was in grave danger and definitely needed saving. No sooner had St. George and the princess had this conversation than they were interrupted by a terrifying roar as the dragon burst forth from the water, heading straight towards the girl. Being the nimble little thing she was, the princess dodged the sharp claws. As she was zigzagging away from danger, George stopped to make the sign of the cross and charged the gigantic lizard, thrusting Ascalon, that was the name of his sword, yep, he named it, into the four-legged menace and severely wounded the beast. George called to the princess to throw him her girdle, that's a belt-type thing, and put it around the dragon's neck. From then on, wherever the young lady walked, the dragon followed like a meek beast. Back to the city of Silene went George, the princess, and the dragon, where the animal proceeded to terrify the people. George offered to kill the dragon if they consented to becoming Christian. George is sounding a little bit pushy, I know. But the people readily agreed, and 15,000 men were baptized, including the king. St. George killed the dragon, slicing off its head with his trusty sword, Ascalon, and it was carried out of the city on 4 ox carts. The king built a church to the Blessed Virgin Mary and St. George on the site where the dragon was slain, and a spring flowed from its altar with water that it is said would cure all diseases. This is the story of St. George and the Princess. It is a classic story of good versus evil and of disease-healing miracles that would have spoken to the inhabitants of 17th century Brescia. The scene depicting St. George and the Princess is painted in stunning artwork by Antonio Cicognara and was mounted on the wall of the Church of San Giorgio. Giovanni Battista Ruggeri gazed up at this painting as family and friends, mainly of his bride Laura Testini, crowded into the church of San Giorgio for his wedding. Giovanni was 22 and his soon-to-be wife 21 as they spoke their vows in the new city he called home. He hoped to make his career in this town, making instruments for the art-loving Brescians, evidence of which could be seen in the wonderful artworks in such places as this small church. Ruggeri would live for the next 20 years in the parish of San Giorgio, the very same George astride an impressive white stallion in shining armour, his head surrounded by a golden halo. He is spearing the dragon, whilst the princess calmly watches on, clad in jewels with long red flowing robes in the latest fashion. In the background is the city of Brescia itself, reminding the viewer to remember that here in their city they too must fight evil and pray for healing from disease, ever present in the lives of the 17th century Brescians. Hello and welcome to The Violin Chronicles, a podcast in which I, Linda Lespe, will attempt to bring to life the story surrounding famous, infamous, or just not very well known, but interesting violin makers of history. I'm a violin maker and restorer. I graduated from the French Violin Making School some years ago now, and I currently live and work in Sydney with my husband, Antoine, who is also a violin maker and graduate of the French school, L'École Nationale de Lutherie in Mirecourt. As well as being a luthier, I've always been intrigued with the history of instruments I work with, and in particular, the lives of those who made them. So often when we look back at history, I know that I have a tendency to look at just one aspect, but here my aim is to join up the puzzle pieces and have a look at an altogether fascinating picture. So join me as I wade through tales not only of fame, famine and war, but also of love, artistic genius, revolutionary craftsmanship, determination, cunning and bravery that all have their part to play in the history of the violin. Before we start, the sponsor for this episode is Florin Leonard Fine Violins. And here is the man himself talking to me about his latest project, a wonderful book called The Archetypal Violins of Guarneri del Gesù.
So I'm Florin Leonard, director of Florin Leonard Fine Violins. I'm an expert in authentication of, in particular, old Italian instruments, a violin maker, a restorer, and a dealer.
On this episode, I'm talking about Giovanni Battista Rogeri, but in Rogeri's later life, he was in Brescia, but in Cremona, when he was about in his mid-50s, a young Giuseppe Guarneri del Gesù was born.
Yes.
And you have something quite exciting that you've been working on. Could you tell us about it, please?
Oh, yes. So, yeah, about 15 years ago, I decided to start the project. I collated by now more than 100 instruments, 100 full-size, high-quality photographed instruments in the book from the earliest part to his last year of life. I wanted to highlight very much the early part of his production. So we don't have any publication yet that highlights also the early works of Del Gesù.
Okay. So in your book, you're documenting his life through instruments from every period of his life.
Yeah.
But what is interesting is that you are also looking at his earlier period, which is less documented.
That's right. In my past 40 years of work, I've come across so many Guarneri del Gesù's that I thought it would be nice to study them and put this knowledge together into one big book. So I wanted to create a volume where all the works that we can today find are shown to any violin maker. The violin makers know Stradivari quite well. We have lots of publications on Antonio Stradivari, but we lack a little bit publication that shows the whole life and the whole spectrum of Guarneri del Gesù's work. And so it is very interesting. Del Gesù was not an as prolific maker as Antonio Stradivari, and also he did not live as long. In this publication, I will publish 100, and I have every single year since the early 1720s represented by at least one example, but more likely like 3 to 4. And that should help the community of people interested in the subject, but also the violin makers who want to understand the maker better or copy him or don't have access to the originals all the time, to get the feeling of holding those pieces in their hand and also see the flow of development throughout the decades of his work. And we can clearly see it. You will realize how he slowly developed, how the scrolls become his own hand, or when he carved his own scroll and when the father created a batch of scrolls that he would make use of, and how he in the 1740s creates his virtuosic style of making. The pictures are high resolution, full size. So it's exact size of the instrument. So people can use these as templates to draw their own models. It's a maker's book, but it is also a book for people who like the history. So for makers, musicians, and enthusiasts, this book should enable them to analyze and understand and then fall in love with the work of this great master. What I add to this whole book is my descriptions of the instruments. I want to share that insight, because if you also describe pictures, it brings the instrument even closer to the eye of the person.
Yeah, and when you describe something, you're really drawing the eye towards it that you might not have noticed before.
Correct.
So this must-have reference book, The Archetypal Violins of Guarneri del Gesù, will be released towards the end of 2024. But be sure to get a copy in your hot little hands. You can pre-order it now by going to the webpage florinleonhardt.com. Go to the shop tab and there you can order your very own copy of this book. Welcome to this first episode on the life of Giovanni Battista Rogeri, the one who moved to Brescia. After having spent the last few episodes looking at the life of the Ruggeri family, we will now dive into the life of that guy who almost has the same name, but whose work and contribution to violin making, you will see, is very different. And we will also look at just why, for so many years, his work has been attributed, erroneously, to another Brescian maker. The year was 1642, and over the Atlantic, New York was called New Amsterdam. The Dutch and the English were having scuffles over who got what. Was it New England, New Netherlands? In England, things were definitely heating up, and in 1642, a civil war was in the process of breaking out. On one side, there were the parliamentarians, including Oliver Cromwell, and on the other side were the royalists, who were the supporters of King Charles I. This war would rage on for the next 20 years, and not that anyone in England at this time really cared, but the same year that this war broke out, a baby called Giovanni Battista Rogeri was born in Bologna, perhaps, and for the next 20 years he grew up in this city ruled by the popes of Italy. He too would witness firsthand wars that swept through his hometown. He would avoid dying of the dreaded plague, sidestep any suspicion by the Catholic Church in this enthusiastic time of counter-reformation by being decidedly non-Protestant, and from an early age he would have been bathed in the works of the Renaissance and now entering churches being constructed in the Baroque style. Bologna was a city flourishing in the arts, music and culture, with one of the oldest universities in the country. But for the young Giovanni Battista Rogeri to learn the trade of luthier or violin maker, the place he needed to be was, in fact, 155.9 kilometres northwest of where he was right now. And if he took the A1, well, today it's called the A1, and it's an ancient Roman road, so I'm assuming it's the same one, he could walk it in a few days, destination Cremona, and more precisely, the workshop of Niccolò Amati. An instrument maker of such renown, it is said that his grandfather, Andrea Amati, made some of the first violins and had royal orders from the French king himself. To be the apprentice of such a man was a grand thing indeed. So we are in the mid-1600s and people are embracing the Baroque aesthetic along with supercharged architecture and paintings full of movement, colour and expression. There is fashion, and how the wealthy clients who would buy instruments in Cremona dressed was also influenced by this movement. Emily Brayshaw.
You've got these ideas of exaggeration of forms, and you can exaggerate the human body with, you know, things like high heels and wigs and ribbons and laces. And you've got a little bit of gender bending happening, men wearing makeup and styles in the courts. You know, you've got dress and accessories challenging the concept of what's natural, how art can compete with that and even triumph over the natural, perhaps. You've got gloves trimmed with lace as well. Again, we've got a lot of lace coming through. So cravats, beauty spot as well coming through.
You've got the powder face, the wig.
Yeah.
The makeup, the high heels. Okay, that's now.
I actually found a lovely source, an Italian tailor from Bergamo during the Baroque era. The Italians like really had incredibly ill tailors and tailoring techniques. And during this sort of Baroque era, he grumbles that since the French came to Italy, not to cut, but to ruin cloth in order to make fashionable clothes, it's neither possible to do our work well, nor are our good rules respected anymore. We have completely lost the right to practice our craft. Nowadays, those who disgracefully ruin our art and practice it worse than us are considered the most valuable and fashionable tailors. So we've got like this real sort of shift, you know, from Italian tailoring to sort of French and English tailoring as well.
And they're not happy about it.
No, they are not happy about it. And this idea that I was talking about before, we've got a lovely quote from an Italian fashion commentator sort of around the mid-17th century. His name's Lampugnani. And he mentions the two main fashions, meaning French and Spanish, the two powers that were ruling the Italian peninsula and gradually building their global colonial empires. And he says, the two main fashions that we have just recorded when we mention Spanish and French fashion enable me to note a strangeness, if not a madness, residing in Italian brains, that without any reason to fall in love so greatly, or better, naturalize themselves with one of these two nations and forget that they are Italian. I often hear of ladies who come from France, where the beauty spot is in use not only for women, but also for men, especially young ones, so much so that their faces often appear with a strange fiction darkened and disturbed, not by beauty spots, but rather by big and ridiculous ones, or so it seems somebody who is not used to watching similar mode art. So, you know, we've got people commentating and grumbling yeah. about these influences of Spain and France on Italian fashion and what it means to be Italian. When we sort of think about working people, like there's this trope in movie costuming of like peasant brown,
yeah,
you know, and sort of ordinary, you know, people, perhaps ordinary workers, you know, they weren't necessarily dressed in brown. There were so many different shades of blue. You know, you get these really lovely palettes of like blues and shades of blue and yellows and burgundies and reds, as well as, of course, browns and creams and these sorts of palettes. So,
yeah,
you know, they're quite lovely.
Yeah, and I'm imagining even if you didn't have a lot of money, there's a lot of flowers and roots and barks that you can dye yourself.
Yeah, and people did.
Could imagine if I was living back there and we, you know, we were like, oh, I want this blue skirt, and you'd go out and you'd get the flowers you needed, and
yeah, definitely. And people would, or you know, you can sort of, you know, like beetroot dyes and things like that.
I mean, and it would fade, but then you could just like, you know, quickly dye it again.
Yeah, or you do all sorts of things, you know, and really sort of inject color. And people were also, you know, people were clean too. You know, people did the best they could, keep themselves clean, keep their homes clean. You know, we were talking about boiling linens to keep things fresh and get rid of things like fleas and lice. And people also used fur a lot in fashion. And you'd often like, you know, of course you'd get the wealthy people using the high-end furs, but sometimes people would, you know, use cat fur. In Holland, for example, people would trim their garments and line their garments with cat fur.
Why not?
Because, you know, that's sort of what they could afford.
It was there.
Yeah. People also would wear numerous layers of clothing as well, because the heating wasn't always so great.
Yeah.
You know, at certain times of the year as well. So the more layers you had, the more warm and snug you could be.
As do we in Sydney.
Indeed. Indeed.
Canadians complain of the biting cold here.
I know. And it's like, dude, you've got to layer up.
It's a humid cold.
It's awful.
Oh, it's horrible. It just goes through everything. Anyway.
It's awful. Yeah.
So at the age of 19, Giovanni finds himself living in the lively and somewhat crowded household of Niccolò Amati. The master is in his early 60s, and Giovanni Battista Rogeri also finds himself in the workshop alongside Niccolò Amati's son, Girolamo II, who is about 13 or 14 at this time. Cremona is a busy place, a city bursting with artisans and merchants. The Amati workshop is definitely the place to be to learn the craft. But it soon becomes clear as Giovanni looks around himself in the streets that, thanks to Niccolò, Cremona does indeed have many violin makers. And although he has had a good few years in the Amati workshop, learning and taking the young Girolamo II under his wing more and more as his father is occupied with other matters, he feels that his best chances of making a go of it would be better if he moved on and left Cremona and her violin makers. There was Girolamo, who would take over his father's business. There were the Guarneris around the corner. There was that very ambitious Antonio Stradivari, who was definitely going to make a name for himself. And then there were the Ruggeri family, whose name was so familiar to his, people were often asking if they were related. No, it was time to move on, and he knew the place he was headed. Emily Brayshaw.
So you've also got like a lot of artisans moving to Brescia as well, following the Venetian ban on foreign fustians sold in the territory. So fustian is like a blend of very stiff cotton that's used in padding. So if you sort of think of, for example, someone like Henry VIII, right? I can't guarantee that his shoulder pads back in the Renaissance were from Venetian fustian, but they are sort of topped up and lined with this really stiff fustian to give like these really big sort of broad shoulders. That's how stiff this is. So Venice is banning foreign fustians, which means that Cremona can't be sold in these retail outlets. So
That's fabric, but did that mirror the economy that Brescia was doing better than Cremona at this point? Do you think because of that?
People go where the work is.
Yeah, because it's interesting, right? Because you've got Ruggeri, this family that lives in Cremona.
Yeah.
And then you have about 12 to 20 years later, you have another maker, Rogeri.
Yeah.
He is apprenticed to Niccolò Amati, so he learns in Cremona. And then he's in this city full of violin makers, maybe, and there's this economic downturn. And so it was probably a very wise decision. He's like, look, I'm going to Brescia. And he goes to Brescia.
He would have definitely been part of this movement of skilled workers and artisans to Brescia at that time. That's sort of what's happening as well. So, you know, there's all sorts of heavy tolls on movements of goods and things like that. And essentially it collapses.
And they were heavily taxed as well.
Yeah, definitely.
It was the fabulous city of Brescia. He had heard stories of the city's wealth, art, music and culture, famous for its musicians and instrument makers. But the plague of 1630 had wiped out almost all the luthiers. And if ever there was a good time and place to set up his workshop, it was then and there. So bidding farewell to the young Giovanni, the older Niccolò and his household, where he had been living for the past few years, the young artisan set out to make a mark in Brescia, a city waiting for a new maker, and this time with the Cremonese touch. Almost halfway between the old cathedral and the castle of Brescia, you will find the small yet lovely Romanesque church of San Giorgio. Amidst paintings and frescoes of Christ, the Virgin and the saints, there stands a solemn yet nervous young couple, both in their early 20s. Beneath the domed ceiling of the church, the seven angels of the apocalypse gaze down upon them, a constant reminder that life is fragile and that plague, famine, and war are ever-present reminders of their mortality. But today is a happy one. The young Giovanni Battista Rogeri is marrying Laura Testini. And so it was that Giovanni Battista moved to Brescia, into the artisanal district, and finds himself with a young wife, Laura Testini. She is the daughter of a successful leather worker, and the couple most probably lived with Laura's family. Her father owned a house with 8 rooms and 2 workshops. This would have been the perfect setup for the young Giovanni to start his own workshop and get down to business making instruments for the people of Brescia. He could show off his skills acquired in Cremona, and that is just what he did. Since the death of Magini, there had not been any major instrument-making workshops in Brescia. Here I talk to Florin Leonard about Rogeri's move to Brescia and his style that would soon be influenced by not only his Cremonese training, but the Brescian makers such as Magini.
Yeah, I mean, I would say in 1732, Brescian violin making or violin making was dead for a bit. So until the arrival of G.B. Rogeri, who came with a completely Cremonese idea into town and then adopted features of Magini and Gaspar da Salò, I cannot say who, probably some Magini violins that would have been more in numbers available to him, have influenced his design of creating an arching. It's interesting that he instantly picked up on that arching, because Rogeri's are always much fuller arched. The arching rises much earlier from the purfling up.
Right. So he came from the Cremonese tradition, but he adopted the Brescian arching idea.
He came from Niccolò Amati and has learned all the finesse of construction, fine making, discipline, and also series production. He had an inside mold, and he had the linings, and he had all the blocks, including top and bottom block, and he nailed in the neck. So he did a complete package of Cremonese violin making and brought that into Brescia, but blended it in certain stylistics and sometimes even in copies with the Brescian style. Mm-hmm. For a long time, we have had, before the endocrinology was established, the Maginis going around, and they were actually G.B. Rogeri's.
Brescia at this time was still a centre flourishing in the arts, and despite the devastation of the plague almost 30 years ago, it was an important city in Lombardy and was in the process of undergoing much urban development and expansion. When Giovanni arrived in the city, there were efforts to improve infrastructure, including the construction of public buildings, fortifications, and roads. The rich religious life of the city was evident and continued to be a centre of religious devotion at this time, with the construction and renovation of churches in the new Baroque style. The elaborate and ornate designs were not only reserved for churches, but any new important building projects underway in the city at this time. If you had yourself the palace and the moolah, you were definitely renovating in the Baroque style. And part of this style would also be to have a collection of lovely instruments to lend to musicians who would come and play in your fancy new pad. Strolling down the colourful streets lined with buildings covered in painted motifs, people were also making a statement in their choice of clothing. Emily Brayshaw.
Another thing that the very wealthy women were wearing are these shoes called chopines, which are like 2 foot tall. And so you've got like these really exaggerated proportions. Yes. As well.
Very tall.
Yeah.
Very
tall, very wide. So yeah. Taking up a lot of space.
I'm trying to think of the doorways that would have to accommodate you.
Yes.
How do you fit through the door?
So a lot of the time women would have to stoop. You would need to be escorted by either servants.
And then you just stand around.
I did find some discussions of fashion in the time as well. Commentators saying, well, you know, what do we do in northern France? We either dress like the French, we dress like the Spanish. Why aren't we dressing like Italians? And kind of these ideas of linking national identity through the expression of dress in fashion. So,
but did you want to, was it fashionable to look like the French court or to look like the Spanish court?
Well, yeah, it was fashionable. And this is part of what people are commenting about as well. It's like, why are we bowing to France? Why are we bowing to Italy? Why are we bowing to Spain? Why don't we have our own national Italian identity? And we do see like little variations in dress regionally as well. You know, people don't always dress exactly how the aristocracy are dressing. You'll have your own little twists, you'll have your own little trimmings, you'll have your own little ways and styles. And there are theories in dress about trickle down, you know, like people are trying to emulate the aristocracy, but they're not always trying to do that.
Well, yeah, it's not practical if you're living, you know, if you're...
And financially you can't either. Like some of these outfits that we're talking about, you know, with one of these huge, like the Garda Infante worn by Marie Theresa, that outfit alone would have cost in today's money like more than $1 million.
Right.
Right. You can't copy these styles of dress, right? So what you've got to do is... you know, make adjustments. And also, like a lot of women, like you, these huge fashion spectacles worn at court, they're not practical for working women either. So we see adaptations of them. So women might have a pared down silhouette and wear like a bum roll underneath their skirts and petticoats and over the top of the stays. And that sort of gives you a little nod to these wider silhouettes, but you can still move, you can still get your work done, you can still, you know, do things like that. So that's sort of what's happening there.
Okay, so now we find a young Rogeri. He has married a local girl and set up his workshop. Business will be good for this maker, and no doubt thanks to the latest musical craze to sweep the country. I'm talking about opera. In the last episodes on Francesco Ruggeri, I spoke to Stephen Mould at the Sydney Conservatorium about the beginnings of opera and the furor in which it swept across Europe. And if you will remember back to the episodes on Gasparo da Salo at the beginning of the Violin Chronicles, we spoke about how Brescia was part of the Venetian state. This is still the case now with Rogeri, and this means that the close relationship with Venice is a good thing for his business. Venice equals opera, and opera means orchestras, and where orchestras are, you have musicians, and musicians have to have an instrument, really, don't they? Here is Stephen Mould explaining the thing that is opera and why it was so important to the music industry at the time and instrument makers such as our very own Rogeri.
Venice as a place was a kind of Gesamtkunstwerk. Everything was there, and it was a very modern type of city, a trading city, and it had a huge emerging, or more than emerging, middle class. People from the middle class like entertainment of all sorts. And in Venice, they were particularly interested in rather salacious entertainments, which opera absolutely became. So the great thing of this period was the rise of the castrato, which the idea of it is perverse. Mm. And it was, and they loved it. And it was to see this person that was neither man nor, you know, was in a way sexless on the stage singing and often singing far more virtuosically than a lot of women, that there was this strange figure, and that was endlessly fascinating. They were the pop stars of their time. And so people would go to the opera just to hear Farinelli or whoever it was to sing. Really, this is the rise of public opera as opposed to the other version.
Which was?
Orfeo, for example, took place in the court at Mantua, probably in the room of a palace or a castle, which wouldn't have been that big, but would have been sort of specially set up for those performances. If I can give you an idea of how opera might have risen, as it were, or been birthed in Venice, let's say you've got a feast day, you know, a celebratory weekend or a few days, you're in the piazza, outside San Marco. It's full of people and they're buying things, they're selling things, they're drinking, they're eating, they're having a good time. And all of a sudden this troop of strolling players comes into the piazza and they start to put on a show, which is probably a kind of commedia dell'arte spoken drama. But the thing is that often those types of traveling players can also sing a bit, and somebody can usually play a lute or some instrument. So they start improvising probably folk songs, yeah, and including that. So you've kind of already there got a little play happening outside with music. It's sort of like a group of buskers in Martin Place. It could be very hot. I mean, I've got a picture somewhere of this. They put a kind of canvas awning with four people at either corner holding up the canvas awning so that there was some sort of shade for the players. Yeah, that's not what you get in a kid's playground these days. You've almost got the sense of the space of a stage. If you then knock on the door of one of the palazzi in Venice and say to the local member of the aristocracy, look, I don't suppose we could borrow one of your rooms, you know, in your lovely palazzo to put on a show. Yeah, sure. And maybe charged, maybe didn't, you know. And so the very first, it was the San Cassiano, I think it was, the theatre, this room in a palace became a theatre. People went in. An impresario would often commission somebody to write the libretto, might write it himself, commission a composer, and they put up some kind of a stage. Public came in, paid. So it's paying to come and see opera. Look, it's not so different to what had been going on in England in the Globe Theatre. And also a similar thing to Shakespeare's time was this sort of mixing up of the classes. So everything was kind of mixed together. And that's why you get different musical genres mixed together. For example, an early something like Poppea by Monteverdi, we've just done it. And from what I can gather from the vocal lines, some of the comic roles were probably these street players who just had a limited vocal range but could do character roles very well, play old women, play old men, play whatever, you know, caricature type roles. Other people were probably trained singers. Some of them were probably out of Monteverdi's chorus in San Marco, and when they weren't singing in church, they were over playing in the opera, living this kind of double life. And that's how opera started to take off.
Yeah, so like you were saying, there are different levels. So you had these classical Greek themes, which would be more like your educated person going, yes, yes, I'm seeing this classical Greek play. But then you're someone who'd never heard of the classics. They were there for the, you know, the lively entertainment and the street performers.
Yes. So the Commedia dell'arte had all these traditional folk tales. Then you've got all of the ancient myths and so forth. Poppea was particularly notable because it was the first opera that was a historical opera. So it wasn't based on any ancient myths or anything. It was based on the life of Nero and Poppea. And so they were real life a few hundred years before, but they were real. It was a real historical situation that was being enacted on the stage. Yeah. And it was a craze. That's the thing to remember is, you know, these days people have to get dressed up and they have to figure out how they get inside the opera house and they're not sure whether to clap or not and all of this sort of stuff, and there's all these conventions surrounding it. That wasn't what it was about. It was the fact that the public were absolutely thirsty for this kind of entertainment.
Yeah, and I was seeing the first opera house was made in Venice.
About 1637, I think it was.
And then by the end of Monteverdi's lifetime, they said there were 19 opera houses in Venice. It was, like you were saying, a craze. It just really took off.
But they had a few extra ones because they kept burning down. That's why one of them, the one that still exists today, is called La Fenice. It keeps burning down as well, but rising from the ashes.
Oh, wow. Like with the lighting and stuff, I imagine it's great.
So, yeah, because they had candles and they had, you know.
It must have been a huge fire hazard.
Huge fire hazard. And all the set pieces were made out of wood or fabric and all of that. Opera houses burning down is another big theme.
Oh, yeah, it's a whole thing in itself, yeah.
So then you've got these opera troupes, which are maybe a little something a little bit above these commedia dell'arte strolling players. But so you've got Italy at that time. Venice was something else. Venice wasn't really like the rest of Italy. You've got this country which is largely agrarian, and you've got this country where people are wanting to travel in order to have experiences or to trade, to make money and so forth. And so, first of all, if an opera was successful, it might be taken down to Rome or to Naples for people to hear it. You would get these operas happening in different versions. And then, of course, there was this idea that you could travel further through Europe. And I think I have, on occasion, laughingly, a couple of years ago, said that it was like the latest pandemic. You know, but it was this craze that caught on, and everybody wanted to experience.
Yeah, opera. So you didn't have to live in Venice to see the opera. They moved around. Yeah. It was touring.
Probably more than we think. Yeah. That whole period, like a lot of these operas, were basically unknown for about 400 years. It's only the last century or so that people have been gradually trying to unearth under which circumstances the pieces were performed.
Right.
And we're still learning a lot. But the sense is that there was this sort of network of performers and performance that occurred.
And one of the things that Monteverdi did, which was different as well, is that before you would have maybe one or two musicians accompanying, yep. And he came and he went, "I'm taking them all," and he created sort of the first kind of orchestras, like where
they
lots
were the
of different
they
instruments.
Were the prototypes of orchestras. And look, the bad news for the violin side of your project, there were certainly violins in it. It was basically a string contingent. That was the main part of the orchestra. There may have been a couple of trumpets, may have been a couple of oboe-like instruments. I would have thought that for Venice, they would have had much more exotic things. But the fact is, at this time, with the public opera, what became very popular were all of the stage elements. And so you have operas that have got storms or floods or fires. They simulated fires. A huge amount of effort went into painting these very elaborate sets and using, I mean, earlier Leonardo da Vinci had been experimenting with a lot of how you create the effect of a storm or an earthquake or a fire or a flood. There was a whole group of experts who did this kind of stuff. For the people of the time, it probably looked like, you know, going to the first big movie, you know, when movies first came out in the 20s, when the talkies came out, and seeing all of these effects. And when we look at those films today, we often think, oh, that's been updated, you know, it's out of date. But they found them very, very, very compelling. What I'm saying is, the money tended to go on the look of the thing on the stage, and the orchestra, the sound of the orchestras, from what we can gather, was a little more monochrome. Of course, the other element of the orchestra is the continuo section. So you've got the so-called orchestra, which plays during the aria-like parts of the opera, the set musical numbers. Then you've got the continuo, which is largely for the recitative, and you would have had a theorbo, you would have had maybe a cello, a couple of keyboard instruments, lute. It was a very flexible, what's available kind of.
Yeah, so there group. Was, they would use violines, which was the ancestor of the double bass, so a three-stringed one, and violins as well. And what else I find interesting is with the music, they would give them, for these bass instruments, just the chords, and they would improvise sort of on those chords. So every time it was a little bit different. They were following a...
Yes. Improvisation.
Yeah, it was kind of absolutely original. You could go back again and again. It wasn't exactly the same.
That is the problem with historical recreation, and that is that if you go on IMSLP, you can actually download the earliest manuscript that we have of Poppea, and what you've got is less than chords. You've got a bass line, just a simple bass line, a little bit of figuration to indicate some of the chords, and you got a vocal line. That's all we have. We don't actually know we can surmise a whole lot of things, but we don't actually know anything else about how it was performed.
I imagine all the bass instruments were given that bass line and like, do what you want with that. So yeah. It would, and it would have really varied depending on musician.
Probably different players every night, depending on, you know, look, if you go into 19th century orchestras, highly unreliable, huge incidents of drunkenness and, you know, different people coming and going because they had other gigs to do. Like, this is 19th century Italian theatres at a point where it should have been. In any other country, it would have. Germany had much better organised orchestral resources and the whole thing. So it had that kind of Italian spontaneity and improvise. The whole idea of opera was this thing that came out of improvisation. Singers also, especially the ones that did comic roles, would probably improvise texts, make them a bit saucier than the original if they wanted for a particular performance. All these things were open.
And this brings us to an end of this first episode on Giovanni Battista Rogeri. We have seen the young life of this maker setting out to make his fortune in a neighbouring city, alive with culture and its close connections to Venice and the world of opera. I would like to thank my lovely guests, Emily Brayshaw, Stephen Mould and Florian Leonard, for joining me today. And if you would like to hear extra episodes such as the wacky story of Clive of India and his connection to an Amati cello found in an attic and support the podcast, go to patreon.com/ The Violin Chronicles, where you can become a member from as little as $1.50 a month. And I'm talking about Australian dollars. And I can tell you, we do not have a strong currency. You will also have access to the Dictionary of Luthiers, another podcast I make with my husband, Antoine. Don't forget to rate the podcast and give me some stars. This really does help the podcast to grow, that simple act of clicking. But for now, goodbye, and I hope to catch you next time on The Violin Chronicles. Mm-hmm.